Good morning. Today is Friday, the 7th of October. Joining us this morning is Eureka City manager and noted baseball fan.
Not quite.
Miles Slattery. Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, boy. Are you ready for our duck question?
Of course. Quack.
All right. Why do we say dark horse?
It's got to do with horse racing. I'm going to say that something to do with horse racing and the odds on dog wins it. So
you're going dog racing or horse racing?
Well, the odds on not favorite is what.
Oh,
I mean.
Okay. I see. From the beginning of the Democratic experience, election of public officials has been seen as being a lot like a horse race. No one knows who will win until the votes are counted, but almost everyone has a favorite. So no disparagement is intended when a public official compares a candidate with a spirited horse. Legend has it that Sam Flynn of Tennessee picked up an easy living by racing a coal black stallion named Dusky Pete. Flynn usually rode Pete into a strange town as though he was in an ordinary saddle horse. Not knowing they faced a champion, local men cheerfully set up races and lost. As a result, Flynn's dark horse became more than regionally noted. Formation of a new political term was probably helped by the fact that anything dark is foreboding and unlikely. At any rate, lingo of the track entered smoke-filled convention halls, and as a result, professionals often joke that an unknown who shows a chance of winning is a dark horse in the campaign.
Kind of the opposite would be a bright elephant?
I was thinking more of a bunny rabbit, a white bunny rabbit.
Gotcha.
Well, you've been kind of halfway busy here in the last few weeks, huh?
Very entertaining.
Yeah.
Good times.
Let's talk a little bit about the discussion and the contemplation of the one way around the zoo and mm-hmm. Washington School. I think a lot of people, I think almost everybody concurs that it's kind of a train wreck. Anyway, the streets are a little skinny. There's a lot more traffic there than what it was initially designed for. But that also sounds like a lot of the streets in the city of Eureka as well. What options were considered?
So, I mean, there's keep it the same way it is or some version of, some version of a one-way. And you're correct. You know, the county did a study probably 20 years ago to talk about development in the Cutton area. And all of those studies that the county did demonstrated that any new development out there is going to need some alternative route to get around that situation there. Both when the Ridgewood development was being looked at as well as Kramer's development, that the capacity for that system to hold new development out there is not adequate. And so that study was required.
Campton really doesn't.
It does, but I think the study was looking at something on Manzanita to have that pop out somewhere on Harris.
A little bit closer.
Yeah. And so that was contemplated, and that was actually listed in their traffic study document. So, yeah, it's, the reason why we look at one way for our from our standpoint is because of the safety. And I know that's very hard for people to understand by adding more cars, but by adding more cars and doing it one way, you have less movement going back and forth. And when the traffic gets, you know, congested, those cars aren't moving as fast.
So is the other option that often is contemplated the traffic signal lights as a way to kind of
cue it,
but also bring the safety, raise the safety index, if that's even such a phrase.
For that, you know, and I don't.
Not that specific location, but in general, are signal lights the other option that are most times looked at?
Typically, they look at collisions and what how many collisions they have at a certain intersection in order to dictate whether or not we put a light in there.
Yeah, that's kind of a trigger, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the typical practice is to look at the collision rate and determine whether or not one is justified.
So for simple traffic flow control, mm-hmm. that's kind of an expensive option.
It is. There's other options, too. You know, you get, the speed humps, other things like that in order to slow people down.
Yeah, obviously, if anybody's driven that area, if you're not aware. I don't know how you couldn't be. There are.
You have
those.
Really good suspension.
Those, yeah. Or you're in a hovercraft, one or the other. those are there, and it seems as if that's addressed some of that speed, at least if memory serves me at all. Slowing down a little bit or diverting off onto the tree streets and shooting down Harrison.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, that was put in front of the zoo there to slow people down in front of the zoo. I think that people, we hear complaints about people going fast on both of those roads, with or without the speed hump. But yeah, that has helped out in front of the zoo for people crossing there.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, the speed bumps, I mean, we got a couple out here by Lafayette. Some see them as Evel Knievel opportunities. They're going to clear the Snake River Canyon. Short term, I guess you survive it. But if you drive that any form of consistency or any type of consistency, the suspension damage has got to be significant.
Yeah.
After, you know, 4 or 5 years of going 30 or 35 over those things, you're going to pay for it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So speed bumps, speed tables, the flashing lights, all those types of things, like the one in front of Harrison K. Mm-hmm. Are they working?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the most recent one that we installed is at the golf course, and that's a pretty treacherous crosswalk there. Basically, you come up the hill on fairway there, and I think it's Herrick. No, it's fairway there. When you come up around that corner right there. And so that's helped a lot. Not that I golf and would know, but sometimes there's, when you push that light, it gives the heads up from a further distance, because when you're coming around that corner, you can't really see at,
the view
at
shed
the pedestrian
isn't,
level.
Yeah. Yeah, so if they work, why aren't we seeing more of them in areas that tend to have the speed? Yeah, you know, 14th is pretty well chopped up. You know, you're not going to gain any momentum. But Harris,
yeah.
And there are some areas there where you have a pretty good run. Obviously, my sympathies on Booner. You know, that's like a tarmac for an airport.
Yeah, I think it has to do with volume on some of those. Harris would probably justify. We do studies all the time to look at those things, and especially when people bring up issues, we'll go out and do traffic counts and look at numbers and speeds and those type of things. And once we determine that, that goes back to the Traffic and Safety Commission with the data to say that speeds are at this level, they're too high,
this is
they're
what you
over
want,
the top,
yeah.
And we either lower the speed limit or add add amenities like you're talking about.
There you go. It's 8:19.
Hi there, and good evening, and welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Weekdays at 7 p.m., it's the Jim Bohannon Show. I'm Jim Bohannon. Join me here on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Eureka City Manager Miles Slattery. Miles, with traffic, yeah, it would be interesting to find out when 6th and 7th Street were turned into one-ways. I think that was in the 60s.
Well, we did a demonstration recently for both of those to go one way.
6th and 7th?
And you're looking at me
they
as
are,
if
dude.
I know what happened in 1960,
well, you, but
Brian.
You've
come
got,
on, brother.
But you've got records. Somewhere there's archives, right, or traffic studies.
Yes,
there
is.
The community reaction, or when H&I were made one way. I remember a little bit of the dust-up when Booner and E. became a four-way. Harrison having the lights. I mean, there have been some of those types of things that have been put in place because of the changing traffic patterns in our area. I suspect that around Washington and the zoo, that's different. That's growth out beyond rather than just better circulation within the city. Are the standards for those two the same when you're looking at major conduit out of town versus just movement inside the city?
They're not the same. No, I mean, you look at traffic counts and you see how many, you know, vehicles are being used in that area and stuff like that. I think that for the Washington area, the connection is basically between two main arterials. You're looking at a very somewhat populous area out in Cutton. It has an arterial that comes in on Walnut that pulls right into that area there. And then there's a connection that needs to come over to Harris. And so the whole point of the bike lanes is that you have bike facilities on Walnut. You have a section that is not connected to another bike facility that has a main thoroughfare. And so we have facilities on Harris, we have facilities on Walnut. This is a way to connect those two so that there is another mode of transportation to get into town. So when H&I is done, that would allow for all of the residents of Cutton to be on a bike and ride their bike from Cutton through that little interchange there at Washington onto Harris, and then when H&I is done, you can get all the way to Old Town. And so you'd have a separated bike lane from Cutton all the way into Old Town.
Well, you have it on J Street now.
Yeah.
So when you look at...
Not all of J, though.
Well, I know, you run into the jail. Okay, fine.
Well, no, you don't have J. If you, south of Boone, there's no bike facilities there, I don't believe.
Yeah, to Harris.
Okay. Right.
Some of us consider them walking lanes.
That's how you get to Harris, right?
Yeah. Has there been a study done, and I know this is probably sacrilegious and it's certainly non-PC, of those bicycle riders, how many are kids? How many of them are the recreationalists on the weekends or in the afternoons? And how many are really commuting? Is there either a raw number or a percentage? You know, I fear that we're investing a ton of money and a ton of talent and resource time also to satisfy 100-150 people. And when you look at that as a percentage of the community, boy, that's a pretty high level of attention that a really small group of people are generating.
I think it's more of a policy decision, and that policy decision has been made by our council. Basically, while yes, the numbers aren't the same as there are for vehicles, that's for sure. Some areas there are more than others, but if you see places where there are facilities around schools. Yeah, when you see places where there are facilities, you definitely see more bike riders. When you have facilities, there are more bike riders. So yes, it is, you know, build it, they will come kind of mentality. But it's also a policy decision that, you know, at some point in time, we're going to need to look at multimodal transportation. A very good point was brought up in one of our council meetings. You know, if we're really looking at the safety of children, I think that there should be a real high emphasis on not having drop-offs around schools. What there should be an emphasis of is having an alternative location that's very large for kids to get drop-off and bus the kids
like school bus
into
drops.
Schools. Yes. And that way, if you go to Washington or you go to Grant is a pretty scary situation when you're looking at
Zane?
Drop-off. Zane, same thing. Zane at least has... And in and out, the queuing's long, but I mean, at least it has a way to get children off.
But
of
there's
the
a lot of kids that are walking,
100%,
and crossing. And,
yes, and so I mean, if we're really, those are the type of things and that policy decisions that need to be made. Is if we're really looking at the safety of the children, should we be having, you know, there's I think 480 students or 500 students at Washington Elementary. Should we have 300 cars dropping off children?
But is that policy of the city or is that policy of the school district?
That would be city schools. The city needs to make sure that our accommodations are take everybody into account. Commercial drivers, public safety, the zoo, the armory.
Just everybody.
Everybody. So, I mean, yes, it's a very high priority to think about the children at the school, but we have to think about all users of our road.
So why not apply that same philosophy to the zoo and the park consumer?
Meaning
off-street parking, drop-off areas, not having to cross the streets, things of that. I mean, I know there had been some discussion in the past about doing something that could accommodate everybody, so it was off the street.
So similar to this situation, it's a space constraint. There's a lot of funding that has gone. The zoo is 67 acres. However, we've gotten a lot of grant money for rehabs of the zoo, Land and Water Conservation Fund. When you get those, there's deed restrictions that don't allow you to convert it. That's what happened with the Sheriff's Woodlot, with Cooper Gulch, when we were looking at that for housing. We couldn't use it for housing because of those deed restrictions.
Jeez, the next topic. It's 8:30.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Times, 8:35. We're back talking shop this morning with Miles Slattery. Miles, I'm sure you're aware of the new information that PG&E has shared about Fortuna and Southern Humboldt and the lack of connections. Other than being very sympathetic to the situations that these folks are dealing with today and for the near future as well, is there any thought that Eureka could be subject to the same edicts?
No, we're fine. I don't think there's going to be any issue. I mean, just based on, we had all the mills and other things like that. I don't think we have a capacity issue at all. I did speak with city manager Fortuna Merritt, and they're hoping to get some support from the state, and hopefully that comes sooner than later. I know that it's really unfortunate for both Rio Del and Fortuna, cause especially Fortuna had a study going about, developing commercial, and they had a lot of plans in the place
and interest.
Yeah.
How do you project or anticipate or develop a safety net so that that doesn't occur and that there are no surprises? Because at least the read that a lot of us have is this was just something that kind of the building community ran into.
Yeah.
You say, well, we can't hook you. What? What do you?
Yeah.
And that's what started to unravel this whole situation.
Yeah. I'd say fortunately for the city of Eureka, we have properties that had a lot of activity on them and a lot of industry that was here for a long period of time.
The historical.
Yeah, and I think that from our standpoint, I don't see that being a problem.
But could they say, that's dandy, Miles, but you guys haven't been using that amount of energy for the last years, and we've reallocated those elsewhere, and you don't think about bringing those things back because it's not there anymore. Kind of like the water.
Yeah. I mean, waters have a water rights and all the legislation regarding that, and I can understand that. I think that's a concern if that was to happen. I don't anticipate that happening. We can't really control that. I think that's why.
But you could monitor it.
Yeah.
Couldn't you? I guess.
I've never heard of
the development
that
department or something. Well, yeah. And,
yeah. I never heard of what happened in
this is new territory.
Dude. Yes, exactly. So, that would be very surprising. And I know that they may have the thing. I think that's why it's fortunate that, the state is stepping in. I know that McGuire was pretty animated when this happened. And so I think that, if something like that were to happen, I think that there would be recourse. I don't see us being in any imminent danger of that happening, that's for sure.
So let's switch to a different that could, this whole sea level rise stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, somebody wants to put a development. You've got England Marine doing their thing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that was a housing project. Mm-hmm. Okay, would that be something that would be permitted? Or would that be changing because of an outside jurisdiction saying, we're not going to let that happen?
So I think it's just knowing the guidelines and the parameters. I think As far as Ingle Marine is concerned, basically what they do is they look at the life of the building, how long it's going to be there, and at what level the water will be at, and whether it'll still be there.
Right?
Yeah. Or basically looking at projections of sea level rise and where you're going to be at 25, 50, 75 years from now. And so I forget what the elevation is, but they met that elevation and they were able to put that based on the life of the building. Right now we're going through a local coastal program update, and there's definitely areas that we need to look at and determine, okay, these are critical infrastructure. We are going to say that we want to armor or we want to protect this because it's critical. Other areas we're going to need to look at and say this isn't so critical and that we need to look at retreat and what does that retreat look like. For
picking
us
picking
right
up
now,
your building and moving it?
Well, depending on what it is. So like Old Town is obviously a big concern for us. Our wastewater infrastructure is obviously a big concern for us. And so those are probably our main points, what they call the section in the local coastal program, the hazard section. Those are areas that we're definitely going to fight hard to protect. We've been in discussions with the Coast Commission.
So how do you protect? Is that a levee? Is that dredging?
So for Old Town, we've had different designs. Right now, we're looking at potentially like a plexiglass on the boardwalk of some sort, obviously engineered to accommodate that.
Oh, something to prevent the rogue wave?
Yeah, from coming up and going over.
Now, with the mouth of the bay being as narrow as it is and as far away as it is, I mean, if something came over the spit...
well, you're talking like a tsunami now.
That's a whole different magnitude.
Yeah. And there are considerations for tsunamis and being in the run-up zone and those type of things, but we're most concerned about sea level rise and what the level is and how high it's going to be. So certain areas, you know, the treatment plant, just like Arcata and ours, that's going to be a real difficult one because a lot of our infrastructure, you know, we're right, you know, at the mouth of the elk
right
there.
And right
so
there.
All
yeah.
of our collection systems and everything go there. I mean, it's going to be a long discussion, but there's ways of doing it. So our collection system that goes kind of from Del Norte down to the treatment plant, that's
from
a
where?
Really large main, Del Norte.
Oh,
because all the way down.
Where'd you grow up, Kemosabe?
We've looked at a lot of different plans for living shorelines that basically attenuate the sea level rise so that it spreads it out for longer and it doesn't have a big
impact.
So
it's more like Clam Beach?
It's kind of like what we're doing at the mouth of the Elk River. You're allowing for more capacity. So you're basically building habitat to allow for more capacity so that it doesn't run up. You know, right now, the way that they look at our sea level rise is kind of a bathtub effect, and it's not really true of what would actually happen. So in other words, they're just saying, here's a shoreline. It doesn't take into account, you know, we have levees here. We have other things here. So when the sea level does rise, it's going to hold there. It's going to fill up sloughs.
Yeah.
Much more so than just come up and over these levees. And so that's something that we looked at as far as living shorelines and those type of things to allow for more capacity.
So if we use the Klamath as an analogy, the brackish water just happens a little bit further upstream.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Or what you do is you create things downstream that allow for it to have more capacity so that maybe the brackish water doesn't come up as high.
You mean like dams?
No, just opening it up. So opening up the ag fields at the mouth of the Elk River. We're putting in 97 acres
How is that going? I mean, we see some stuff going on out there.
So the berm is being built for the trail to be extended a mile south. All of the main channels have been dug. Right now it's mostly removing Spartina and planting. And
when does it fill up with water?
Pretty soon. I'll talk to Katie and see when that is. Katie's been running that. She's been killing it. But when that happens, we're going to have a drone footage of it filling up. It's going to be pretty cool. You'll enjoy it. I'll bring it to you.
Okay.
You'll geek out on it.
It'll look like a flood. KINS, News and Information Times, 8:43.
Hi, folks. Fly Humboldt wants to remind you that flying local is buying local. And with airlines going to seven cities serving hundreds of destinations, it's easier than ever to get to where you want to go from Humboldt County's airport. That's right, you can fly on American, Avelo, and United Airlines nonstop to Denver, Hollywood, Burbank, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. Flying has never been more convenient or affordable, so book your trip now. For more information, go to flyhumboldt.org.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Time. It's 8:48. We're back talking shop this morning with Miles Slattery. There was a story this morning about changing the name of 2030 Park, and that there was a survey. So I went on to say, keep it 2030. That wasn't an option. I have, this is me, a tough time because the 2030 Club, which is a service club, donated the funds for that for kids. You know, it's a kids-based organization. Yeah. Why not recognize their efforts? Why not allow it to be what it was? And rather than going through, I'm sure that that was part of the initial agreement, was that this was going to be called 2030 Park.
So they will still be recognized. There'll still be recognition of 2030 Park there. When we did the first study related to this, 2030 Park was still an option when they did the survey. And after that survey, it didn't make the top three, but that doesn't mean that we're going
to
take away 2030 Park. What do you mean?
You said it didn't make the top. Okay, who made
all
the determination?
All of the survey respondents. So we
how many were there?
I'd have to go back and look. I don't know.
Okay. Well, I mean, out of 28,000 people, was it 10%, 5%, 1%?
I don't know.
I heard something that said 250. I think that's what maybe. Peter had this morning. That's less than 0.1% of those city population.
Yeah, and it hasn't been made determined yet. It's going to be ended up going to council. When this goes through the process, so when we change a name.
But the three names, there is no 2030 as an option.
No, it didn't make the top for the overall. So that would be the overall parks name. So this would include, we'll still call some portion of Jacob Haney. We'll still call a certain portion of the park being 2030. But the overall name of the park is going to change. I shouldn't say that. It's not going to change. The process that's followed, we get all this information. In order to change public space, it goes to the Planning Commission. The Planning Commission considers a resolution. And then after the Planning Commission makes a recommendation, that goes to council. And then
at the Planning Commission level, if the community, residents of Eureka, I mean, not those outside of Eureka, but residents of the city of Eureka, the ones that should be the only ones with a voice on this, come out strongly
should
enough.
Should only the residents of Eureka have a voice on the Washington one way?
No, because it impacts the county using, I mean, that's the connection from the county.
Well, I know.
But this is a city park.
Well, I understand, but this city park.
You don't want Fortuna residents to come in and comment.
Well, when we put $6.5 million into this park, I can assure you there's going to be people from all over this community using that park.
Who's paying the taxes for the park?
Who's paying the taxes for the roads?
Yeah.
I mean, City of Eureka residents.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I guess the concern that I've got is this is kind of like when Walmart was first going to come here and people from all over the county were weighing in and it was a City of Eureka decision.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't slow people down. You know, there were comments from people from L.A. And it's like, this is not... Not your area, dude. Focus on your community.
Yes.
You know, make your community the way you want it. Mm. Don't try to make the entire state the way that you want it. That's not the way we're set up. And I'm concerned that this might also be similar, and that once folks are starting to become aware of it, is there an opportunity at the Planning Commission level or at the council to come in and say, this is 2030, this should be 2030, make it 2030 or keep it 2030.
I mean, that's why the process is there. And
so the survey is just one input. It's not the
exactly
only one.
It's exactly like Washington. It's not the only input. So like you said, there's only 200. For the survey that we did for Washington, there was 800 and something out of 28,000 people. Of those 800, 34% of those respondents from outside of the city. So if you look at just City of Eureka resident respondents for that survey, it was probably in the 600. So you have 600 that are doing something for 28,000. So that's just how it works. And so it goes both ways.
But that's cool that at least there's still input opportunity.
Yeah, there's going to be Planning Commission as well as council.
See, we could stir it up here.
You don't like Millick? You don't like Egret Park?
I like 2030. Egrets are in the bay. They're not in the playground. See everybody on Monday.
They will be in the playground.